Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Thursday, April 25th, 2024. I'm Guy Benson. This is the Guy Benson Show from New York City. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com is our online home. Our podcast is free and on demand when the show is over every day. The show is based in Washington, D.C., but I'm here in the Big Apple because tomorrow morning I will be co-hosting Fox and Friends, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Looking forward to that. I'll be up very early. Hope you will join us on TV. We've got a big lineup on the radio today. We'll get to our first guest in studio in just a moment. Coming up later in the hour, Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis, Republican, New York. She was at Columbia yesterday with Speaker Johnson. We'll ask her about that situation. Shannon Bream has been watching the Supreme Court today, oral arguments on the immunity case involving Trump, January 6th, all of that, all of it playing out while Trump is in court in New York City on the Alvin Bragg so-called felony case involving hush payments to Stormy Daniels. So a lot to cover with Shannon. Looking forward to that conversation. And then Brian Riedel from the Manhattan Institute. There was some really bad economic news that dropped today. Worse than expected GDP growth in quarter one and worse than expected inflation. You put those two together, it's not a good picture for the U.S. economy and Bidenflation and Bidenomics. We will get the breakdown with Brian Riedel ahead in our final hour. Joining me here, right next to me, in his studio, quite frankly, is Brian Kilmeade, host of the Brian Kilmeade Show on Fox News Radio, 9 to noon weekdays. And of course, every day he's on the couch, co-host of Fox and Friends. I'll be with you tomorrow. Looking forward to that. I'm filling in for Steve.
Have you picked out an outfit? You ready to go?
I actually have.
You have?
Yeah, I've got the suit ready to go. I've got the tie in mind. You got to look sharp when you're competing, especially with all due respect, the other male co-host,
Lawrence.
Because Lawrence knows he's a sharp dresser.
But here's the thing, Guy. I think Lawrence is going to be on location where he dresses like every man. He dresses like, which is harder to do.
Okay, so in that case, I'll be fine.
Yeah, he'll be fine. It's just me.
Okay,
yeah,
well
you
then,
can address
oh,
me,
the pressure's
no
off.
Right.
Absolutely. LJ's not around. He's out there in the field.
Right.
Right, okay.
I'm feeling so much better.
Brian, I saw you were on the news channel a little while ago talking about this. Neither one of us, to my knowledge, are attorneys, but we follow the news. We're following this case, talking about the New York case. What do you make of it so far? Because, you know, the legal talking heads seem to be mostly in agreement that it's a very weak case against Trump.
Right.
But if you watch some of our competitors in the TV space, I mean, they're wall to wall on this, treating it like it's the trial of the century.
It is for them. It is. This is the moment because no one's been watching, especially CNN. So they have six or seven lawyers say the same thing, except for Arthur Idala, who does a great job over the last 2 days, who just saying, what are you talking about? There's no crime here. What's the crime? Well, he got capture and kill a story. That's not a crime. To have a story be suppressed, not a crime. To plant a story, not a crime. To come together with a plan to help yourself, help your social life, whether it's your relationship or something else, that is not a crime. How many times do people plant stories in the Washington Post? How many times do so-called sources with the Hillary Clinton camp say they know exactly what her plan's going to be to close out this election? Well, you get that source, unnamed source, to tell you this, or there's some unrest inside the Trump camp. There's Trump camp people, they tell you this, they become a source. So now you have other people planning a story about Marco Rubio in the National Enquirer that says whatever, and they have something on, I believe, Ted Cruz. It says his father, they says his father was in on the JFK assassination.
It's crazy. It's
but
ugly.
It was in the Enquirer.
Yeah,
so
nasty.
Did that change the primary?
No.
Of course not.
It's just dirty, gross politics.
Right.
But just like the hush money payment to a porn star is gross and dirty and unseemly. The question is any of this a crime? And I guess the argument, again, as a non-lawyer, has been, well, if they categorized the money that was paid to Stormy Daniels a certain way other than what the perfect above-board fashion should have been, that could be a crime. They're like, well, that's a misdemeanor, and that expired, right, like, years ago. So they had to somehow turn this into, like, a violation of federal campaign laws that the feds even haven't charged here. They looked at it. They didn't charge. Alvin Bragg's predecessor looked at this, didn't charge. But now leading into the election, they dredge up this thing from years ago and dream up a new way to make it 2-3 dozen felonies.
Yeah.
It reeks to high heaven, Brian.
It does. And you have the President of the United States going there to a court. They didn't fully define what the charges were. So they said, well, just wait when this thing goes to trial. Just wait. Okay, we're waiting. What are the charges? So what they're doing now, according to reports, and it makes sense, they're all just trying to give Michael Cohen some credibility and some corroboration. Because when he gets on the stand in a week or two, or in 2 days after Karen McDougal, I think he's going to go on there, and they're going to, first thing they're going to say is, weren't you convicted? Didn't you have tax invasion? Weren't you a part of this? Weren't you actually constructing some of the scheme, orchestrating it? And what is your greatest complaint? That your client, this is the best line ever. Jonathan Turley says, I guess the main charge is that he listened to Michael Cohen, his lawyer, and that's Michael Cohen's axe to grind? Do you think Donald Trump was orchestrating this? This is so, Michael Cohen is so far behind it. When David Pecker was asked, does Donald Trump know what you were doing? He said, I assume so. The defense says, objection. What do you mean you assume so? So then I guess I may strike it. Donald, you don't know that Donald Trump knew about this, and you can't say or assume it. That's not you can't use that as evidence.
And Michael Cohen has just no credibility, right? He'll say whatever he has to say on behalf of Trump until they have a falling out, and now it's all negative to Trump. The guy is admittedly a criminal, Michael Cohen. I mean, you're not dealing with high caliber, high character people here. And I'm sure this is what I'm thinking, Brian. They're going to have this just cavalcade of people coming before the jury. They're going to testify, and it'll be a bunch of sordid business, sordid stuff. It's like, okay, Trump, maybe he was directing it. Maybe he was winking at it. Maybe he had no idea or some combination. Even under the worst case scenario where Trump's like, you know, directing everyone to do precisely what he wants, it's still not a felony.
Well, Guy, think about this. One of the things they're saying is that he manipulated an election. This scheme affected the outcome of her election. Let's back that up a little bit. Okay. How would the election be affected if Hillary Clinton didn't smash her server? What would have been on that server that we found out? What if Hillary Clinton didn't go outside her campaign to hire Perkins Coie and Mark Elias in order to scheme up this whole Russia hoax situation?
Yeah, what if they didn't pay for the the Steele dossier?
Yeah. Yeah, what about, I mean, all that affects an election. And for those people, say, let's take a step back from that. If I knew about Karen McDougal, I wouldn't have voted for Trump. If I knew about Stormy Daniels, I didn't vote for Trump. Really? Did you hear the Access Hollywood tape? It is those two stories to the 20th power. And he still won without a staff. They all basically resigned. He still won in the final hour. So what are you saying? My hope is that those two lawyers are married more to the law than they are to what might be the New York agenda. And two lawyers on the jury. And they're just going to say, look, guys, this is not a crime. That's what my hope is. From what we know, 7 days in, 5 of the 4 of those days picking a jury, not a crime.
Yeah, I mean, people, to your last point, I think this is worth thinking about because they're trying to claim it's election interference, and it's like, oh, it's a federal violation of campaign finance laws because they categorize an expense this way instead of that way.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, paying off money to this woman that he was having an affair with, allegedly. He denies it, but I mean, I believe it. I think he was absolutely doing it. And he had all sorts of affairs throughout his life. People know this about Donald Trump. No one going into the 2016 election was sitting there saying, I think Donald Trump's been nothing but an upstanding citizen who has always been 100% faithful to his wives.
I know I don't have to tell you this, but Bill Clinton had a few things going on when he was governor of Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
Remember they had the bimbo eruption team?
Yep.
So does that mean that if I knew about all the bimbos, I might have voted for George H.W. Bush? I don't think so. It was built in, the 60 Minutes interview.
Yep.
You saw all these people come out prior to it. Then you saw the Paula Jones accusation. He still got reelected. So at any point, we could go back in the past. Now, if JFK ran for reelection, when we now that we know what went on in 3 years, can you imagine what would have come out in 2024 about JFK? Probably a lot. FDR, probably a lot, right? He basically had a full-blown relationship and ignored his wife for 8 years. So that's a pretty big deal. In this day and age, I guess we would have impeached him.
Maybe.
Or he wouldn't have got elected.
Right.
That's what we're supposed to assume.
Which I don't think passes the smell test.
No.
So you've got, and by the way, as I said, to me, three of the most important points on this from the legal standpoint are what I said earlier, which is number one, they're trying to say like they're enforcing federal campaign finance laws that the feds themselves did not want to charge on this. They looked at it and said no. The guy before Bragg looked at it and said no. And then the judge presiding over the case, who is so often siding with the prosecution and with Bragg's office, the man donated to Joe Biden's campaign. Like, I am not, you know this about, I am not a big Trump guy. I'm not waving the red flag with the Make America Great Again.
But you're being fair to him.
I'm fair to him, I think. And when he's wrong, and I went after him yesterday on something where I disagreed and I said it, when I think he deserves it, I say it. The judge in New York City overseeing this, I think, politicized to the hilt case. It's just bogus, BS. The judge donated to Joe Biden, the opponent of Donald Trump in the last election. And now there's a rematch. And you've got the guy with the gavel in the black robe sitting there up there on the bench making all these decisions about whether or not this man is going to potentially become a convicted felon in time for the election. He's a donor to the other guy's campaign. How is that? I don't know. How is that allowed?
You know, they go, you're going after his daughter. His daughter's 35. His daughter's got a $4 million contract with Adam Schiff as a consultant.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to be kidding me. So Adam Schiff is the number one rival of Donald Trump when he was president of the United States and after.
And he's running for Senate now.
So, but the thing is, if you're a judge, what they always say is, it's so bizarre. The system has it. A judge will decide if he or she should recuse himself. Shouldn't we have an outside person decide if your wires are crossed in a certain case? Or if you think, hey, you know what, Juan Merzan, I know you pretty well, buddy. It seems like you're pretty fixated on this guy. I recommend I pull you back. You know, we're both in the judge business. Pull back.
Yeah, it's like, and even just for public appearance, if you want this to look legitimate on the up and up, which to many Americans, including non-Trump fans, it already doesn't. Then you put someone presiding over the trial who donated to the Democrat opponent of Donald Trump, and now they're running against each other again. And the guy's daughter is making millions of dollars from the Democrats in this exact election cycle. Can you not just find any other judge in Manhattan who didn't donate to Joe Biden?
I mean, this is one of those dynamic days with the immunity trial going on. The audio was fascinating. And then when we got up today at 6:30 in the morning, we got a note last night that there was going to be a 6 a.m. Trump event. We don't know what it is. Next thing you know, he's meeting with the steel union. He's got 200 to 500 people out there, and it is electric. And we're going to it live. And prior to him getting out of his SUV, they're chanting his name. These guys are legitimate hard hat guys with vests on. 500 guys, chanting his name in New York City, two blocks from his place. And the guy comes out and speaks. Then he comes and talks to the press. You know who doesn't talk to the press? The president. No, it doesn't take any interviews with the president. You got the former president with two active trials going on, right? One, consequential trials. He had to come up with $175 million 2 weeks ago. He's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he walks over to a bunch of cameras and says, throw out your questions. I mean, and hearing them chant USA and Trump while he does that in New York City.
Union guys. And
it was so impressive. I mean, you can't script that in the bodega thing. These are one of the two big stories of the week.
I was going to say that. I know you have to go here in just a second, but he's kind of ball and chain tied to New York for a while. He can't really leave very much. The campaign's still figuring out ways to get him out of the courthouse into very interesting settings, including the bodega, highlighting crime, highlighting the unfairness of Alvin Bragg. They've been making some smart moves, I think.
Big, really good moves. And now they got – Columbia is probably going to be a big decision after Speaker Johnson got kind of yelled at. He looked good. But, you know, if you put him into a hostile environment, it could go south. Right now, we put him to two very positive environments that aren't scripted. There's no extras there like Hillary Clinton did. These are real people. But the next question is, go to a supermarket, point out how expensive everything is for New Yorkers. I would go in front of the Danny Penny subway and say, down here, a Marine stood up and is a hero, and the same guy that's screwing me is screwing him,
yeah, going
Alvin
to
Bragg.
Daniel Penny station makes a lot of sense. Going to the grocery store and doing a little compare and contrast on the sticker price, then maybe pay for some people's groceries.
Yeah.
He loves that kind of move. This is kind of like the political chess game they're playing when the powers that be are throwing everything legally at him in this city right now. Brian Kilmeade, we always listen to you 9 to noon on Fox News Radio. For the previous 3 hours each morning, you're co-hosting Fox and Friends. I'll be joining the party tomorrow morning. Looking forward to that.
And they did a great job with our studio, right?
Oh, yeah. They put my name up here.
Yeah, 7.
I said, get Brian Kilmeade's name out of here. I can't see
that. I heard you yelling.
Can't stand the guy. I got here a little early. Everyone.
Right.
That's bellowing at the top of my
lungs. They were crying as usual.
Yeah,
what else?
The beatings will continue until morale improves. On the Guy Benson Show, Brian, thanks.
Go get him.
All right. We'll be right back after this. Just getting started on this Thursday from New York.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
I'm Guy Benson. So I saw this. This is very interesting to me. We talk a lot about polling on this show, often to do with politics and the presidential race, Senate races, etc. How about this? This is a poll done by Harvard of young Americans. So 18 to 29-year-olds, the youngest voting cohort. And they asked people about their priorities, the issues that they care most about. And there were 16 different issue sets. Now, when you hear the White House and the Biden administration and Democrats and a lot of people in the media talk about young voters and the Democrats being concerned about young voters and appealing to young voters, what issues often come up these days at the very start, the very top of the conversation? Climate change and Israel and Gaza. Right? It's like, oh, well, Biden needs to appeal to these young people. They're very, very upset about Israel and the war in Gaza. And climate change is their existential issue. And if they're not happy with the Democrats, then they might not show up. So you better pander to them pretty hard. Look, here's the actual polling among 18 to 29-year-olds right now. Among 16 issues, the top three, unsurprisingly, are inflation, healthcare, housing. Basically, the cost of things, big things. Do you know where climate change ranks? List of 16. All the way down at number 12. Climate change is at 12, at bottom third. You know where Israel and Palestine is? 15th out of 16. Only 34% say like it's a big deal for them. So the ones who hate Israel and support Hamas and are making these encampments on these campuses and yelling and screaming for the cameras and threatening and menacing and assaulting Jews on campus, yeah, they're making a whole lot of noise. But of 16 issues facing Americans, Israel and Palestine is number 15 out of 16 to young people in this Harvard poll. Isn't that interesting? Like, the conventional wisdom says one thing. The activists are very good at putting those agenda items front and center, making it seem like these are the top issues. They're not. By the way, you want to know what dead last was? 16 out of 16? You'll never guess. Student debt. That's the other one they keep talking about. Yeah, I got to forgive that student debt because of the young people. It is dead last on the issue, partially because they're not taxpayers yet. They're not being asked to do the bailing out. Many of them are being asked to bail out, to be bailed out. But this goes to show that it's a very small sliver of people, even among young folks, who are demanding these bailouts. It's just an inversion of what you see in the media so often.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
Thank you for listening to The Guy Benson Show. We're in New York City today, GuyBensonShow.com, every day, podcast free and on demand as soon as the show is over. Well, on the program yesterday, as we kicked off our middle hour, we dipped in to some remarks being given blocks from here, uptown in Manhattan, at Columbia University, where the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, was making an appearance and standing behind pro-Israel students, Jewish students, and calling out the rampant anti-Semitism and pro-terrorism agitations that have happened on that campus now for weeks on end. And he had some other members of Congress there with him in solidarity. I was glad that he went. I know that there was some shouting down and people chanting at him and booing and all of that. I don't really see how that's much of a problem. You had an American leader show up doing the right thing and a bunch of thugs who support Hamas heckling him. That's to be expected. This is who they are. They are the dregs of society. Yes, including these Ivy League snots. The absolute dregs. Speaker Johnson had every right to be there. He was right to be there. Kind of wonder where, I don't know, some of the New York representatives on the Democratic side were. Chuck Schumer, for example, says he's very pro-Israel, unless he's calling for regime change in Israel in the middle of a war. Chuck Schumer is very pro-Israel. He says he's Jewish. He represents New York. Where's Chuck Schumer at Columbia? Took a Christian from Louisiana to go up there and say what's up, which needed to happen. That's a show of leadership. And as I said, he wasn't alone. One of the other people there accompanying him is a representative from New York. On the Republican side of things, this should not be partisan. We've had Richie Torres on the show. He's been fabulous on this issue. But Nicole Malliotakis from the 11th District here in New York, she was part of that delegation, and she joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Could you describe to us, before the public remarks that you guys made and some of the jeering and the chanting and all of that, what did you experience when you met with some of the Jewish students on campus before the press conference?
You really- Nice meeting with the Jewish students, in which they told us basically that, you know, they're scared. They've been threatened. They've been, some of them, assaulted. Some students have even been spat on. They've had to see swastikas painted on campus. Really terrible to imagine that this type of anti-Semitism is occurring in the United States of America, particularly New York City, a place that has been, you know, so welcoming, so diverse for forever, right? I mean, this is the last place you'd think you'd see this type of anti-Semitism, and yet here we are in one of the most prestigious universities, supposedly, in the country, an Ivy League university, and this is how Jewish students are being treated. So it was really horrifying to hear from them, their experiences. I felt saddened for them, but they were so grateful. They were so appreciative that Speaker Johnson made the trip to come meet with them. You had to see them smiling and how much they thanked him and appreciated the support of members of Congress being there to have their back and to come with the message that we did, that anti-Semitism is not to be tolerated anywhere in the United States, especially our college campuses, and that we needed to work together to eradicate this all across America.
Yeah, a lot of these Jewish students, I've heard from them across the country now for months, they feel hung out to dry, especially on campuses where the administration won't stand up for what's right, won't enforce basic law and order or campus rules, and they're allowing these mobs of terrorism sympathizers to just run roughshod over campuses. And you know, Columbia is probably the worst example, but certainly not the only one. And we keep getting these updated reports throughout the day, Congresswoman, that the administration at Columbia and the president at that school recently testified before Congress, didn't go very well, but they're in negotiations with the student protesters and the people who are running this encampment that's not allowed to be there. This is not something that's permitted. They've been given warnings. They cleared it out once and they just came right back. And the school's just sort of like, oh, well, I guess let's just negotiate. Why are they negotiating? Just assert authority and take care of the problem.
Yeah, it's absolutely ludicrous. Actually, right after we met with the students, we met with the university president, and we said, what is the red line here? When are you going to take action to shut this down? And her response was so unsatisfactory. It was basically, well, we're gonna see if they'll leave on their own. We're negotiating with them. I said, I mean, I don't understand what happened to, you know, campus guidelines, rules for the university. If you break those rules, you're expelled. That's the end of the story. The fact that they're negotiating with these students, it's like, it's just another example of lawlessness in New York. I mean, you know, whether you're a criminal, a repeat offender, revolving door, in and out of jail, committing more crimes, whether you're illegal immigrants that are coming in, getting free hotel rooms, or you know, these protesters that are committing hate crimes against their fellow colleagues in school, and they're not being held accountable. It's just adding to the left-wing woke ideology that there are no consequences for bad behavior or illegal behavior. And that is why we called for the university president to resign. The one thing that she's been right about is that there needs to be a reset at the university, and the reset starts with new leadership. She has to go. And until that happens, we're going to see that these kids are just going to continue to take over this campus. And meanwhile, you have students there, some that are not even Jewish, that are afraid as well, and they're upset because, you know, they're being forced into remote learning. Their college experience is being stripped from them. They pay $90,000 a year to go to this institution. They worked very hard to get there. And now they're being, basically having their academic experience taken away from them by a mob of anti-Semitic and, in some cases, pro-terrorists. I mean, these people are, in many ways, it makes you scared for the future of this country. That
yep.
This is an Ivy League institution, and they're proud, some of them, to actually have support of Hamas, who called them future leaders.
Yeah. Oh, no. The Hamas spokespeople put out a statement yesterday endorsing the student protests. It is mutual admiration. They love Hamas. Hamas loves them. I saw the supreme leader, terrorist in chief of Iran, put out a statement supporting some of these protests in New York City and elsewhere. It's sick. It's very sick stuff. So you guys then met with these students and then came out to the microphones and made your statements. And you could hear in the background all of these people yelling and screaming and booing and chanting and profanities and all of that. Talk about how that felt. And obviously you guys didn't budge. You didn't take the microphones and leave. You stood there and you had your say anyway.
Yeah, I mean, well, actually, it was, I don't know who planned to put us out there right in front of the encampment to give our remarks. Maybe that wasn't the best place to be, but in a way, it was a lot of fun, actually, to be there, because we knew we were there for the right reasons. And, you know, these students needed to hear what we had to say. And the best was Anthony D'Esposito, my colleague, who basically yelled into the crowd and said, if you're proud to have the support of Hamas for what you're doing here on this campus, you're part of the problem. He said it straight up, and I thought it was great. But to see the disrespect, you have the Speaker of the House of Representatives and anybody who came to speak, regardless, right? I mean, to have heckling and cursing at him and vulgarities, if they're doing this to us, imagine what they're doing to their fellow Jewish students. And that is really the underlying issue here. And actually, one of the students told me that he had an American flag that he was draped with when he was marching through the campus, and he was attacked. He was assaulted for having an American flag. So he says it's much deeper than anti-Semitism.
Oh, yeah.
It is a hatred of America and our allies and our principles as a country. So it really is disturbing. But it's one of the reasons why I've introduced legislation to strip federal funding from these institutions. You know, Kathy Hochul said, oh, why are they here? They don't have a reason to be here. You know what? We actually give a lot of taxpayer money to institutions like Columbia and other nonprofit and universities across the country. We need to revisit federal funding of these institutions, and they should be stripped of their funding if they can't control the campus and stop, if they allow anti-Semitism like this to fester. They don't hold their professors accountable. The fact that Columbia still has a professor who, not too long ago, shortly after October 7th, actually, praised Hamas. They have two professors, at least, that have praised Hamas, that have tweeted support for Hezbollah. I mean, that is outrageous. And so we need to send a strong message, hold these universities accountable. And by the way, I have another bill that would strip visas from foreign students who are participating in these anti-Semitic events.
Yeah, if you are from another country and you have the privilege of coming to America to attend a ostensibly elite institution, and you are breaking the rules, breaking the law, and supporting terrorists, why on earth should you be allowed to stay in this country? You have no right
exactly.
to, you have no God-given right to be here. Just the entitlement, the arrogance of that, it's like, I think it makes a lot of people very upset. I think you're exactly right on the defunding point. These private schools, many of them, take all sorts of government money. And they say, oh, well, we're a private school. Yeah, that's true. But if they want that spigot of money that you guys control in Congress to keep flowing, I think it's completely reasonable, given what's happening, for you guys to use that as a point of leverage, a pain point for these gutless cowards who run a lot of these schools. And I just want to come back to something that you said. Did I hear you correctly that Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, was basically asking why a congressional delegation would be at Columbia, like you guys shouldn't be there?
Yeah, and the answer is because we don't have leadership in New York to actually show up and show these students support.
Yeah, like where is Senator Schumer?
U.S. And you asked a great question. Senator Schumer is the highest ranking Jewish elected official in the country. He represents New York, and he hasn't come. I haven't seen him do much of anything. He's one of the last people to actually send out a statement condemning the anti-Semitism at Columbia. And so, and Hochul has shown zero leadership. I mean, she has no consequences for anybody that does anything wrong, including, you know, robbery or whatever crimes you commit in New York City. There's a bail law that Kathy Hochul put in place that will release you back on the street. So this is the woke left ideology that has been of zero consequences. You can do whatever you want, no penalties. And it has taken over New York City. And I think that what we're seeing on this campus is just an extension of that.
No, it's just, my mind is reeling right now because there's this huge problem, this festering, disgusting problem on a campus in the middle of New York City, the crown jewel, you know, worldwide known location in New York State, the governor of which has put out, you know, statements being like, oh, bad on anti-Semitism, we don't like it, fine. She hasn't shown up. She hasn't gone to campus to stand in solidarity with the Jewish students, to my knowledge, or met with them. And then you guys show up, and she's like, oh, well, they're not from here. Why are they here? They're members of Congress. Like, you guys don't have a right to be there to do the right thing when, as you said, there is federal money at stake, number one. And secondly, correct me if I'm wrong. I have it right here on my rundown. I believe I introduced you correctly, Congresswoman. What state are you from? Where's your district? What state would that be?
Yeah, well, you know what? I happen to be the only Republican representing New York City in Washington. And that's right. I mean, I was proud to be there with my colleagues. It would have been great if some Democrats showed up and showed their support as well. And maybe they, you know, don't do it with us, do it on your own. But these students, I have to say, they were, again, so grateful we were there. They feel nobody has their back. They were just smiling ear to ear, thanking the speaker for coming, and they've just been so excited about the fact that he came and took some time to spend with them. And you know who else was in town yesterday? The vice president, by the way, was in town, and she didn't come over to Columbia to say anything.
It's probably for the best.
You know, it's just
who knows what she would have said? Who knows which side she would have taken? I honestly don't know.
She would have laughed. She would have, you know, done her laugh.
She would have. Probably. That's what she always does. But, you know, you have these students who feel besieged on their own campus in the United States of America because of their faith and their identity, because you have literal terrorism supporters bullying them and taking over large swaths of the campus. And they are grateful that you guys came to show your solidarity. And the governor of the state where this is happening is criticizing you guys for being here, even though, as you note, you're a congresswoman from New York City. I saw other New York representatives there. She's not the only leader, thank God, from New York, because if she represents all of the leadership in New York, then these kids on Columbia, they would absolutely be twisting in the wind on their own with zero support from the likes of her. So I'm glad that you were there and using the platform and the power and the influence that you guys have to draw attention to this, because it's the right thing to do. It's, you know, very disturbing to see so many of these images. And we had a Columbia student on the show yesterday, very upsetting hearing. This is a guy from Israel whose grandmother survived the Holocaust, and they routinely call him a Nazi. It's just, it's absolutely sick. Congresswoman, very quickly before I let you go, you were talking about some of the other challenges in New York City. Have you seen the video? I know the New York Post had a big story about it. It's a big brawl of these illegal immigrants outside, I think, one of these shelters.
Which one? There's been so many of them.
The one with the baseball bats and all that? Midtown?
I've seen the one with the police officers being assaulted. I've seen the ones with them taking over the streets in Manhattan. This happened multiple times. There have been multiple stabbings. There was even a death. A migrant-on-migrant crime-related stabbing that ended up in a death. This is outrageous that our governor, our mayor, continue to incentivize people to come to New York City, give them a free luxury hotel room when New Yorkers are having a hard time keeping a roof over their head, putting food on the table for their families, and you're telling them they have to pay to put people in a hotel room that, by the way, there have been over at least 1,200, at least, and that was a couple months ago, that number's from, arrests of these individuals. And what happens? Because of Kathy Hochul's bail law, they get released back onto the street. There was one woman who was arrested 8 times for pickpocketing, and she's going back to her luxury hotel room at our expense. And it's a disgrace that the Democrats allow this to happen, and that Schumer, again, stops all of our border security proposals that we pass out of the House, some with even bipartisan support, won't take any of them up in the Senate.
Yeah, and it just feels
obviously refuses to reverse his policies.
And to this point, it just feels sometimes in New York City that it's repeat felons, illegal immigrants, and literal terrorism supporters who are running the show, and they feel like there's no consequences. They have total impunity and immunity to do whatever they want. That's the message being sent right now, and it's a toxic, dangerous one. Nicole Malliotakis, Congresswoman from New York City, on the Guy Benson Show. Congresswoman, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective. The Guy Benson Show.
It's the Guy Benson Show. We are back. We were just talking with the Congresswoman about some of the insanity, the madness, the lawlessness here in New York City. What about on the other side of the country? I saw this story. Bill Malugin, our colleague, was tweeting about it. I'm going to go out on a limb and say this might be the most California story I've seen in a long time. So Santa Monica, that city, very high-end city, right? There's a lot of money out there. And, of course, it's very left-wing, very blue. Santa Monica has decided they're going to help tackle the homelessness crisis, which is really bad in that state, really all across the West Coast. It's extra bad. They are building homeless housing facilities at a cost, ready for this, of $1 million per unit. $1 million a unit to build apartments, basically, luxury-looking apartments for the homeless. And in the artist rendering that they put out, they actually have a Porsche in the drawing, like in the driveway. So drive your little Porsche over to your homeless housing, $1 million a unit. Oh, and by the way, I'm sure some of that is union contract stuff. Guess when it's going to be ready? 2030, with all the regulations. Pure California out there. Take a bow, Santa Monica. Another hour coming up on The Guy Benson Show.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a brand new hour here on the Guy Benson Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Guy Benson in New York City. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. The podcast is always free and always on demand wherever you get your podcasts. Or GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com. You've got lots of options. Catch me tomorrow morning on Fox and Friends. I'll be co-hosting that program 6 to 9 a.m. on Fox News Channel. As we enter this middle hour, a Fox News alert. The Dow down today, tumbling 375 points. I'm not surprised. Finishing up at 38,085. And I think part of that was jitters that went throughout the market. Market spooked by bad GDP numbers. Significantly worse than expected in quarter one. Then you couple that with worse than expected inflation. Not a pretty picture, to put it mildly. So we will talk to Brian Riedel about the implications of the economic news and some other very significant policy announcements from Joe Biden on that front coming up in our next hour. So please stay tuned for that. I want to begin this hour by addressing something, and I wasn't actually planning on doing this, so I've sent our team scrambling to grab some audio for you so I can talk about something that's happening right now. We've talked about what's happening at Columbia, and we did so in the last hour with the congresswoman here from New York City. I want to get to in a second what is happening today at my alma mater, Northwestern, a place that I care about a lot, that I think overall has handled campus culture since October 7th quite poorly in many ways, and I've said so publicly. I'll get to the developments today at Northwestern in just a second. Before that, though, I want to play for you. This is also from Columbia, just to give you a sense. We were talking to Nicole Malliotakis about how Kathy Hochul, the governor in this state of New York, questioning why the Speaker of the House and why other congressional Republicans even bothered to show up at Columbia. Why are you here? You're not even from here. There are federal issues at stake. There are civil rights at stake. It's also the right thing to do. I know that might be a confusing concept for Kathy Hochul. Meanwhile, a whole lot of silence or equivocation or both sidesing is what we saw from the president in the face of this kind of stuff. This delegation led by Speaker Johnson met with some of these students, many of them Jewish, a few of them Israeli. We spoke to one of them here yesterday on set on this show. They're scared. They've been harassed. They've been, in some cases, assaulted, driven out of public spaces on their own campus, or even driven off their campuses completely. There's a Jewish pro-Israel professor. They locked him out of the school. The administration did. They sort of deactivated his key card for his own safety, they claimed, while they also pretend that this is a peaceful protest. So many of the apologists and the defenders. Look at the squad, for example. Peaceful, peaceful, except when it's not, but we won't talk about that. Those Jewish students who met with members of Congress yesterday, the type of harassment and ugliness that they have been dealing with privately sounds a little something like the soundbite I'm going to play for you here in just a second. This is one of the, we believe, Columbia students, one of the rabble-rousers, pro-terrorism radicals running the show at this encampment. An encampment that's not allowed on campus. An encampment that the administration has said, you can't be here anymore, leave. And they say, basically, no, bleep off. They brag that they're going to stay there through graduation. They're willing to ruin graduation. They're excited that they're costing the school thousands of dollars. You must meet our demands. All this nonsense. Well, the other day on this show, we actually played you a clip. Do you remember this clip? This was from one of the night sessions at that encampment at Columbia, where some pro-Israel students were on the main lawn, sort of the main quad of campus, near the outskirts of this encampment. And then you had the mob get together to drive them off of their own campus. And there was a ringleader with a very distinctive voice, and everyone was chanting in unison, in repetition of what he was telling them to say. Very cult-like, very creepy. If you missed it, here's what it sounded like. This was just a few nights ago at Columbia.
So that we can.
So that we can.
Start to push them.
Start to push them.
Out of the camp.
Out of the camp.
One step forward.
One step forward.
Another step forward.
Another step forward.
We ask,
we ask
that you please respect,
that you please respect
our privacy and our community guidelines,
and our community guidelines,
which you have so far disrespected,
which you have so far disrespected.
Okay, and just enough. They want these students not to be able to even stand in public spaces on their own campus and respect the privacy of the people who are squatting and occupying that part of the campus illegally. Just the gall of these people. And just the cult sing-songy back and forth there, I think, is so weird. And kind of chilling when you understand the cause that they're doing this on behalf of is Hamas terrorism and slaughter of Jews. Now, you might say, well, that's maybe an exaggeration. Nothing about that was violent. It was weird. It wasn't violent. It's not a call to violence. Well, I just saw on social media a video put out by someone at Columbia with a very distinctive voice. I am not 100% sure this is the same person, but the voice sounds similar based on what we can see over the mask. The appearance looks roughly similar. This is, from this account, a Columbia student posting a video on social media in which he says the following.
Zionists, they don't deserve to live comfortably, let alone Zionists don't deserve to live. The same way we're very comfortable accepting that Nazis don't deserve to live, fascists don't deserve to live, racists don't deserve to live, Zionists, they shouldn't live in this world.
One step forward. I think that's him. I'm not a voice matching expert. Pretty confident. Not saying it officially on the air. Even if it's a completely different person. Very distinctive voice. I mean, he first says Zionists shouldn't be allowed to live comfortably, which is at the very least justifying constant harassment. Because remember, the vast majority of Americans and the vast majority of Jews are Zionists who believe that Israel is a sovereign state with a right to exist and defend itself. That's Zionism. And so if you're saying if you're a Zionist, you can't live comfortably, that is a promise of harassment. Let's make the Zionists, and that's in quotes, it's really they're talking about Jews in particular, let's make the wrong, bad-thinking vast majority of Jews, let's make their lives miserable. That's the context to that. That's the subtext. But then he decides in his zealotry to double down further. Not just that Zionists don't have a right to live comfortably, just play the start of it again.
Zionists, they don't deserve to live comfortably, let alone Zionists don't deserve to live. The same way we're very comfortable accepting that Nazis don't deserve to live.
Okay. This is, I don't know what that is other than some sort of a call to violence, a death wish. Zionists don't deserve to live. What is the opposite of living? What is the alternative to living? There's one thing. If you're not alive, you're something else. That is an unbelievably offensive thing. And apparently, according to sources at Columbia, this video was shared with the administration and they've done nothing about it. If there was some student saying black people don't deserve to live, that person does not remain a student at a school like Columbia for another hour. It's over. And so is any chance of employment for the rest of that person's life at any sort of like, you know, major institution or corporation. You're done. This is at least casting a death wish on the vast majority of Jewish people. That's what that was that you just heard. He said it openly, on camera, on purpose. And then, in case that wasn't offensive enough, I don't know how much worse it could get, he, in the next breath, compares Zionists to Nazis. Like, oh, well, Nazis deserve to die, so do Zionists. Same thing. The modern state of Israel exists because after the Holocaust, it was clear that in Europe, it wasn't a safe place for Jews. 6 million of them were rounded up and exterminated by the Nazis. And when finally that evil was stamped out and Nazism was crushed and World War II was won by the good guys, the world community got together and said, you know what, let's return the Jews to their ancestral homeland so they can have a state of their own to live in peace and defend themselves if necessary, because clearly they were not defended on the continent of Europe. So Israel was created, the modern state of Israel, on the same land where Jews trace back millennia of family life to biblical times. And the Arabs, later the Palestinians, were given many opportunities for two states and side-by-side coexistence. And of course, every time they said no, and they've always said no. Palestinians have always said no to peaceful coexistence and often take offers, very generous ones, of two states and a peace deal. And they respond to that with vicious, deadly, lethal violence against Jews. But the modern state of Israel in 1948, 47 into 48, came into existence, winning an immediate war for their survival because they got invaded by everyone. They won. Just like they won the subsequent wars for survival, started by their enemies surrounding them. The modern state of Israel was established because of the Holocaust and the horrors of World War II. And for this punk to talk about how people who believe in the state of Israel having a right to exist, that they don't deserve to live, and then also comparing them to the Nazis that hunted down and murdered millions of Jews within the living memory of people who are still alive, is about as sick as it gets. And either that's the same guy or he's got a twin, including a voice twin. In what world is that acceptable? Apparently, at least for now, in the world that is Columbia University, Ivy League, New York City, USA, 2024. Now, at Northwestern, where I went, this morning, some students started setting up their own encampment on Deering Meadow, right outside Deering Library. And it has gotten already ugly. A bunch of outside agitators, not from campus, have shown up. Every type of low-life thug imaginable in the hard left, like, you know, communists, all these people, they have descended on Northwestern to help them defend this encampment that the school says is not allowed. They sent the police in. Campus police showed up, and they were driven back by the mob. There's video of it. You have people shoving and hitting the police. Students, faculty, I've been told, physically resisting the police, who were outnumbered. The school said, this cannot be here, and we're going to clear it. And then they were prevented from doing that. And I got photos literally during the commercial break, just taken. The tents are up. The sun is shining. They're not going anywhere for now. Someone that I know who's a student journalist was there documenting this. Journalist. Student journalist. With his camera. And on camera, one of these masked thugs sees him, and they don't want coverage. They want to select what press coverage. They want their privacy, just like the insane thing at Columbia. They're setting up on, it's private property, but out in public, doing a thing they're not allowed. And then if they're filmed, they object to that. So this person marched over to the student journalist camera and assaulted him and knocked the camera down while wearing a mask. It's assault. It's trespassing. I mean, we're racking up crimes here. Is there going to be a consequence? I want to actually read to you what the administration had to say about this, but I have to take a break. So let me do that real quick. I'll continue the thought on the other side. Don't go anywhere.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. So my alma mater, let me pick up where I left off, Northwestern. I've been critical of leadership. I think it's been very weak. Had a conversation with a top administrator for like an hour this week. Had a good, I think, constructive talk. And I was told that some changes were coming. And lo and behold, today they put out new interim guidelines for student conduct to give the university more tools to just keep order and enforce things. And within this statement put out by Michael Schill, who's the president at Northwestern, well, he wrote this: any violation of the rules contained in this document or in our policies could lead to disciplinary actions such as suspension or expulsion and possibly criminal sanctions. So that was released the same day as the encampment going up, this morning, early this morning. And here was the response from the school. Official statement from Northwestern. Quote, earlier this morning, community members attempted to set up a tent encampment on Deering Meadow at the university's Evanston campus, an act that is prohibited under university policies. University officials, including Northwestern Police and representatives from Student Affairs, are on site and have informed the group of the policies. They are working with the demonstrators to have tents removed. Students who refuse to remove their tents will be subject to arrest, and their tents will be removed by the university. Community members who do not adhere to university policies will face discipline. So they made it very clear. This is not going to fly. You cannot be here. You can't set up an encampment. We're sending in the police. We're going to take it down. You've been warned. This is the policy. Okay. All in all, pretty good. And certainly, I would say, an improvement over some of what we've seen, this mealy-mouthed, wishy-washy nonsense at Northwestern. Seems like they're drawing something of a line here, seeing what's happening at places like Columbia, for instance. And then the chaos ensued where they sent in the police and the police were driven back by this mob. I retweeted some of the videos. Shoving police. It appears to be students, and I've been told faculty in some cases, shoving police officers. Ignoring the warnings from the school. And then this whole pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, communist hive mind, they put out all of their notices to Chicago and their various comrades. And then a ton of non-Northwestern people have now shown up with gear and to encircle the camp and not let people in. At least one student journalist was assaulted for documenting any of this. I mean, this is out of control and can get worse. The school has to back up the promise and the threat that they made. They have asserted their authority. They need to get police and other police. It can't maybe just be campus police. Get authorities and officials to go in and clear this place. And people who resist should be arrested and prosecuted. And students, particularly behaving worst, should be expelled from the school. Your move, Northwestern. Let's see what happens.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
Of The Guy Benson Show. We're halfway through. Thanks so much for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free and always on demand. Fox News alert as we begin this segment. The trial has wrapped up for the day down in Lower Manhattan, this Trump trial. This is the New York case, the hush money, all of that. And moments ago, the defendant, the former president, Donald Trump, came out of the courtroom to the cameras, as he's been doing on a regular basis, and he said the following.
Today was breathtaking. In this room, you saw what went on. It was breathtaking and amazing testimony. This is a trial that should have never happened. This is a case that should have never been filed. And it was really an incredible day. Open your eyes. And we can't let this continue to happen to our country. On another matter, you know, the economy has just been reported to be doing very badly. The stock market's way down, and some horrible numbers came out, including very high numbers on inflation, and in particular gasoline, at $7.50 in California. That usually leads the way. It's going to happen here, too. And very importantly, as you look at the various colleges all over the country and beyond colleges, because it's happening in other areas too. You see what's happening on the front having to do with Palestine and Israel and protests and hate, anger. Biden is sending an absolutely horrible message. Horrible, horrible message. He has no idea how to message. He can't speak. He can't put two sentences together. He doesn't know what to do. This is not our president. This is somebody that shouldn't be doing what he's doing because he can't do it. He can't do it well.
All right, so that's the president, the former president, making a number of comments on multiple fronts because he can't be out campaigning because he's in the courthouse for this stuff. So he gets out of court and he starts talking about the economy. We'll talk about the bad numbers he was just referring to in the next hour. He's talking about what's happening on campuses. We just finished talking about that as well. He said, this is a case, the case against him in New York, that should not have ever been filed. And I'll just note that people who agree with him are the feds who looked at these facts and decided not to file a case. And the person who ran the DA's office before Alvin Bragg, who looked at the same facts and decided not to pursue this case. But years later, after this alleged crime, years, way past the expiration of the misdemeanor statute, they've decided to turn it into a felony somehow and bring this to trial right before an election. Not a coincidence. So that's the New York trial. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., a very busy day involving a different trial. This is the federal case tied into January 6th and the election. And this claim that Trump has made, and he and his attorneys made, that he has absolute immunity as president and can't be prosecuted for official acts while he was president. Is that true? Is that constitutional? That was a discussion. That was a debate. Oral arguments today at the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was a pretty explosive day of oral argument and testimony. And with us now to break it down is our friend and colleague Shannon Bream, chief legal correspondent here at Fox News and anchor of Fox News Sunday, who was watching it all extremely closely throughout the day. Shannon, thanks so much for your time.
Great to be with you, Guy.
All right. If you can just give us a lay of the land. I tried to sort of tee up what was happening at the high court today as best I could there. If there's any more context that's needed, feel free to add that in. And then just give us some of your top lines about what happened today.
Yeah, I think you sum it up perfectly. It's really a question of where you draw the line, if you do, on immunity for a former president for acts he committed while he was in office. His legal team is arguing that there's absolute, complete criminal liability immunity for a former president, meaning that anything he did that would in any way connect to his official duties would be completely cleared from any criminal liability. The other side also, to a lot of people, sounds equally extreme, that everything he did in connection with January 6th opens him up to criminal liability. There was no protection, that he doesn't have any protection against criminal liability for acts while in office. So that was the starting place. We went from there. And while it seemed that there were people dug in on both sides, there were really a lot of justices who didn't fully let us know where they're going.
Okay. So, I mean, I saw some of the hypotheticals being put out there by some of the justices, and the response from the Trump team was like pretty disturbing, where they're saying, oh, you know, if he's going to get an assassination squad together for a political opponent and order the murder of an opponent, is he totally immune? This is not just Trump, any president, totally immune from that if it's an official act and he's calling out hit squads, basically. And there were other similar examples that were offered that were quite extreme. And Trump's team kind of, in some cases, were like, yeah, that would be covered. I mean, I'm not a lawyer at all, Shannon, but I think to the average person hearing some of those exchanges, people are like, well, what are they talking about? That sounds that sounds nuts. That sounds crazy and totally dangerous.
Yeah, and it does sound, though, they backed off of just how vehement they were about that in the D.C. Circuit, the lower court, when you had this conversation about what if he ordered SEAL Team 6 to go out and get rid of an opponent. You know, there seemed to be some concession today that, like, hey, okay, there are things that there were clearly would be criminal liability for anybody doing. But what the real argument got sticky for the Trump team was when they pushed what actually classifies as an official act. And that's where you had a conversation about some of those things that seem like ridiculous hypotheticals. But then they would draw it right back into real time, too. Justice Kavanaugh was one asking about, okay, LBJ, did he lie about Vietnam? What happened there to the country? Is that something he could have been prosecuted for? Of course, the example with President Obama and drone strikes that took out Americans overseas. What about that? I mean, there were so many real world and hypothetical examples that came up. There's plenty for the justices to chew on.
Some of the questions, I know Justice Kagan, for example, was going through some of the hypotheticals, and I found myself, at least some of the transcripts that I read, agreeing with at least what seemed to be the posture or the thrust of her questions, where it's like, at least as an average citizen here, I feel like, no, there's no way that that would constitute an official duty and that the president would be immune for doing it. And I guess there was some hair splitting about what would count as an official duty versus like a private action while a president is still in office. I don't really know how to parse that out, but it seemed like that was one of the questions that was sort of being bandied about in the arena today. Another one had to do with whether the court is actually going to settle this question themselves right now or kick it back down to a lower court for further clarification and debate. What are some of the possible outcomes in your mind?
So let me read you a little bit of what you referred to about some of these questions from Justice Kagan. She says, a president who ordered the military to stage a coup, but he's no longer president. He wasn't impeached. He couldn't be impeached. But he ordered a military coup, though you're saying that's an official act. The Trump attorney says, I think it would depend on the circumstances whether it was an official act. And if it were an official act, he would have to be impeached and convicted. Because their argument has always been, got to be impeached first, then be convicted. But there were a number of justices who said, what if he's out of office already? Then you can't impeach him. There's no grounds to do that. So he could never be convicted on this. And I think that's where it got really tough. And she said at one point, asking about an official act, he's saying it could be, depends on the hypothetical. She says, the answer sounds to me as though it's like, yeah, under my test, it's an official act. But that sounds bad, doesn't it? And it's, the courtroom laughed.
It sounds really bad. It sounds really bad. Like, it's okay if you've got the commander in chief ordering the military to stage a coup for whatever reason. And that's what they're trying to say. Well, it depends if that's an official act. That sounds like a pretty damn official act if you're the commander in chief. And if you then leave office and you're no longer there, there's no criminal liability for doing something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think the justices cannot go that far. That's why they're going to have to, like you said, find the contours first. I think you're so right to point out private act versus official act, something that's part of their official duties. They spent a lot of time on that today. It's possible, though, they come back, these justices, and say, okay, we do think there's some level of immunity, but it's got to be delineated by private act versus official public act. Now here's some guidance, lower court, and we're going to send it back to you to figure out everything that's in the indictment, whether it falls into one category or the other. Justice Barrett said today, hey, if you agree, as Trump's attorneys seem to concede, that there are some private acts in the indictment that would be actionable. So she's saying, all right, if we send it back to the lower court to decide what's private, what's public, what's official, would the special counsel be willing to just say, all right, we'll strip out everything that everybody agrees is a private act and just let this case go forward on what's an official act so that you can get, you know, speed with this, because clearly you guys have an idea that you want to get this done in a hasty manner. And the special counsel, Michael Dreeben, arguing for them, seemed to say, nope, we have a whole package. All of this stuff is connected. We want the jury to understand every conversation, every email, every text, all of it that was happening. And they don't seem to have any interest in separating them out. But it's possible the court does say, here's the guidance. Now go back to the lower court and hash this out.
If that happens, and if I were a betting man, that's probably where I think this is headed. I think the Supreme Court wants no part of big binding precedents helping Trump, hurting Trump, anything like that on this front. They also feel like some of these questions really do have to be resolved because Americans want to know, not just about Trump, but moving forward. Okay, what actually is the law here? What does the Constitution say? I think guidelines and then kicking it back down to hash out some of the nasty, sordid details of this particular case is the likeliest option. That's just sort of my gut on this. And my understanding is at least four of the justices hinted somewhat at that today, which is not quite five. But if Roberts wants to maybe avoid something massively politically combustible, that might be something of a reasonable out if that's what they're looking for. The question is, let's say that happens, but we're getting ahead of ourselves, Shannon. But if that were to happen, then what does that mean for the timeline of the trial? Because the longer this thing drags out, I think the likelier it is that they probably can't bring this thing to court as they want to before the election.
I think you're right. I think there's a very good possibility that happens, and your timeline would be right, because if they have to go back and break apart the indictment by deciding, okay, what is going to remain a part of the case? What does everybody agree is a private act, or a fact finder or lower court decides this is a private act, this is a public act? That's going to take time. So to do all of that and then restart the trial pushes it, I mean, either on top of the election or you would think just after it. Now, if President Trump wins, then clearly a lot of this federal stuff will evaporate.
Or at least be on hold for years, potentially. Just very quickly, less than 30 seconds, Shannon. Oral arguments over? Like this is now in the court's court, so to speak? The oral arguments are finished?
Exactly right. So usually the Friday after a case, they take a vote. That's the initial vote. They assign the opinions. They start writing them. And as you know, votes can change in that process.
Yep, and time is of the essence. Friday is tomorrow. We'll see where this goes and when they announce what their ruling might be. A lot going on today. Shannon Bream, thanks so much for your time. It's the Guy Benson Show. Stay tuned. We continue here on the Guy Benson Show. We're talking earlier in the week about the package that passed both houses and was signed into law by the president on foreign aid and other matters. Despite flaws and reasonable objections to it, I overall was in favor. And one of the components of it was this, not TikTok ban, but a throwing down of a gauntlet legislatively, where ByteDance, the CCP-controlled Chinese company that owns TikTok, they have to sever ties and sell it, or within a period of time, it will be banned in the United States. Massive bipartisan support. I think that's good. Because, and this is the real tell, they've sent out executives at TikTok to say that they're going to fight this and they're not going to sell. The Chinese government and their puppets at ByteDance, They don't care about the money. This is the point that needs to be made over and over again. You could offer them an insane valuation, double, triple the amount that it would be worth. And I think it's worth a lot, actually, because people love the app. They're addicted to it. Lots of kids. You could make a lot of money selling TikTok. Let's say you made them an offer of double what it's worth. Just a gargantuan sum. They're probably going to turn that down. They're vowing to turn it down. Why? Because it isn't about money. This is not a financial asset for the Chinese government and ByteDance. This is an espionage and propaganda asset. You look at how the app is designed and used in China versus how it's designed and used and deployed here. Completely different. They can put their thumb on the scale on algorithms, what our kids and young people in particular are seeing. For a lot of them, this is their number one or only news source, which is frightening. CCP knows this. The commies in Beijing know this. And if they can just put their propaganda in front of the eyeballs of millions and millions of young people in the West, particularly the United States, that is gold that is worth way more to them than any amount of money. Then, of course, all the data collection, the espionage opportunities there. This is why it is the right decision to force this issue the way that Congress now has, with Biden signing it into law. And the defiance of TikTok, sort of the meltdown, I think it is extremely revealing. I was on Gutfeld last night. This was one of the topics. And almost to my surprise, I was the only person on the panel in favor of this move. If you look at polling, vast majority of the public agrees with me. Vast majority of Congress across the aisle agrees with me. These days, we are an unserious country and society in a lot of ways for many reasons. This was just like a small sign, like a faint beacon of seriousness on an important issue. I think letting a foreign adversary dominate the news and information intake of a new generation of Americans is like culturally, societally suicidal. It's like letting the Soviet Union decades ago run our network news channels and the New York Times. Never would that be allowed. And yet we have people, I think, making, and including folks that I really like, I just disagree with, making bad arguments in favor of letting the CCP continue to hold these strings. So valuable to them, not on the money front, as I point out. And they make arguments about the First Amendment, which does not apply, I think, to foreign adversaries' ownership of companies like this. You're not violating Americans' First Amendment rights. And if they're willing to sell, Americans now own the app, great. Do all your dances, do whatever you want. Have at it. Some people were claiming that it's an overbroad law on this front. I don't think that's true either. It was very narrow, and it named specifically the hostile countries that cannot have an ownership stake in these types of apps. And it's the most hostile countries to the United States in the world. They are named and shamed specifically. It's not broad. It's not vague. That's why I think it being narrow and focused and necessary, it attracted the support that it did. We also saw, and I mentioned this yesterday, Donald Trump trying to attack Joe Biden on this, which I think is unfair, short-sighted, and wrong. Trump was right about TikTok when he was president. And to flip-flop just to pander to young voters, I think is, I get the politics of it. I still think it's the right thing for the country. So going after Biden for signing it is mistaken. Where you can go after Biden potentially is the fact that his campaign has announced they're going to stay on TikTok and see where this thing goes. Because they only care about the next few months between now and November. Then who cares what happens to TikTok? If they can exploit it right now to get young people to vote for them, they're willing to do it, even if they are admitting it's an espionage and propaganda tool for a communist regime. They're staying on the app. Hit them there for hypocrisy. That's a wide open front for attack. Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up next. Some very significant economic news. Spoiler alert, it's not good. Dropped today. We will get a full rundown from Brian Riedel. You need to hear this straight ahead.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
Happy hour time on the Guy Benson Show on this Thursday. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Our podcast is always free when the show is over on demand, no charge. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Lots of options there. We are broadcasting today from New York, and no matter where we are doing the show from, this hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Our friends over there, delicious, refreshing, alcoholic, so 21 plus only, always drink responsibly, thelongdrink.com. Catch me tomorrow morning on Fox and Friends. I will be guest co-hosting in for Steve Ducey. Looking forward to that, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. With that, let's get to Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, longtime budget wonk on Capitol Hill. Brian, good to have you back.
Glad to be back.
Okay, let's start with some big picture economic news. Today, we learned that the U.S. economy in the last quarter grew at a significantly lower rate than expected. Economists were anticipating 2.5% growth, and in fact, it was 1.6%, so falling short of expectations. And then on top of that, we have prices increasing, inflation increasing, again, more than expected. We've seen that for a number of months in a row. I'm not an economist, unlike you, but that seems like a pretty bad combination to me.
Yeah. If you just look at the GDP numbers, economists will tell you never to overinterpret one quarter, because it's a short period of time, and often there's timing shifts that affect one quarter. Like this quarter's GDP was brought down by inventories being drawn down, which will rebound next quarter. That's more of a timing shift. What worries me is the combination of sluggish GDP and rising inflation. You would think that if you're having a quarter where GDP dips a little bit, you would hope inflation dips a little bit too. So the fact that now inflation looks even worse relative to a slowing economy, this is a concern not just for us now, but it probably means the Federal Reserve is going to have to keep interest rates higher a little longer as well.
People are using the term stagflation, at least worried about whether that might come about. Technically, this is not stagflation territory, but I can understand why people are looking at these two numbers together, side by side, and starting to at least whisper about that word.
Yeah, inflation has remained stubborn. We continually are told that President Biden defeated inflation, it's over, setting aside the nonsense that it still wouldn't hurt people because prices still remain elevated.
Right.
There's the fact that the inflation rate, particularly core inflation as well, it is staying elevated. It's not dropping as much as we wanted. It dropped down to about the 3-4% range, and then it stuck there. And like I said, when the economy is only growing at about a 1.5% rate and inflation is 3-4%, it's not quite stagflation, but it's heading in that direction.
Worse than expected growth, worse than expected inflation, at the same time, a bad combination. And then, speaking of worse, deficits. The president has claimed ludicrously falsely that he's reduced deficits and debt, not even close to true. What are we learning on that front?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, again, last year the deficit doubled from $1 trillion to $2 trillion during supposed peace and prosperity, which should never happen. And the deficit continues to rise this year, not only because of rising spending, but interest rates are growing on the debt so fast. Just last week, we sold 52-week Treasury bonds at a 4.9% rate. Now, the Congressional Budget Office tells us that interest rates are going to stay at 3-4%. If they go to 5%, you're looking at budget deficits of $4 trillion within a decade from now, because interest is going to cost a quarter of all of your taxes.
That's in a year? $4
trillion? $4 trillion in 1 year, a decade from now. The annual deficit will be $4 trillion a decade from now if we extend current policies and interest rates keep going where we're currently selling Treasury bonds at.
Okay. And speaking of current policy, we saw, and I noticed you had flagged this on Twitter, President Biden's official Twitter account put out a boast that he is going to allow the Trump tax cuts to expire. And this is what Democrats have been talking about. They opposed the Trump GOP tax cuts and reforms in 2017. They said it was going to cause Armageddon. They made all these predictions, virtually all of which were wrong. The economy was very strong after those tax reforms. And you saw benefit to people across every income group. You also saw the economy pick up. Unemployment hit 50-year lows and historic lows among all sorts of demographics. I mean, the list goes on. And what the Democrats had anticipated and warned about in really apocalyptic terms did not come to fruition. But they kept referring to this as a tax cuts for the rich scheme benefiting millionaires and billionaires. And at the time, many of us made the point repeatedly, no, actually, it cuts taxes for every income group on average. So across every income group in the country, there was a tax cut. And now with Biden at least promising to let the tax cuts expire, people are now raising the alarm saying, well, hang on, this means tax increases across every income group. I saw the Tax Foundation, nonpartisan, they put out a calculator of what this would mean for various families. And they had like 10 different hypothetical families, working class individual taxpayers, middle class families with kids, wealthier people. They had all sorts of different demographics represented. And I clicked on each of the profiles. And for all of them, a tax increase would result from the expiration of the tax cuts. All of them, ranging from hundreds of dollars to many thousands of dollars. So, Brian, explain to us exactly what the White House is arguing here on the tax cuts that they've said forever. It's only for the rich and for the billionaires and the millionaires. But that's not true. And a lot of people will learn painfully that's not true if these tax reductions are allowed to go away and sunset, which is at least what that tweet from Biden suggested.
Yeah, I mean, an easy rule of thumb is that the tax cuts cut family taxes by about 10% across the board. So whether you were in the bottom earning group or the highest earning group, everybody got their income taxes cut by about one-tenth. So the White House will say the richer saved more in dollars. Well, yeah, because they were paying more. Everybody got about a 10% tax cut, which means when we reverse the tax cuts and let them expire, all groups can expect a roughly 10 to 11% tax increase from that level, pretty much across the board, 10 to 11% tax hike. In fact, about three-quarters of the cost of the tax cuts went to families earning below $400,000, three-quarters of the cost. But the White House is trying to play a little game. What they say is these Trump tax cuts were terrible, and we're going to make them expire, which is what they tweeted out, and we're going to claim $3 trillion in deficit savings when they do expire. That's what their budget did. Their budget claimed the savings. But then they turn around and tell all but the top 2%, actually, we're going to extend it for all of you except the top 2%. So they're trying to have it both ways. They want the talking point that the tax cuts are terrible and should expire. They claim all the budget savings from expiration, but then they tell everyone, but your taxes won't actually rise because we really won't let that happen.
Yeah, so I think this is important. I think the tax cuts should be extended for everyone. They benefited everyone, as you pointed out, all income groups. But, I mean, that's just clumsy sleight of hand that you just described, with the White House saying, okay, we're going to make all the tax cuts go away for everyone. And at least theoretically, that's going to save, quote unquote, a bunch of money because taxes will go up and we'll get a whole bunch of new revenue. Now, I'm not really sure that's how it works. I think that tax increases hurt the economy. Tax cuts generally help the economy. We saw tax receipts, like revenues, soar after the tax cuts because the economy was doing so well. So they've been wrong about everything, but at least in their world, they say if we get rid of the tax cuts, we can recoup all these dollars in tax increases, and that will help us in our deficit calculations, because as you were just describing a moment ago, the deficit situation is dire. So they want to put all those hypothetical dollars into the deficit bucket just for the purposes of making their numbers look less bad, basically. And then, as you point out, even though the tweet that we're discussing did not make any distinction, they were saying we're going to let the tax cuts expire. Separately, they're saying, well, we might renew the tax cuts for 98% of the country, which, again, underscores the dishonesty. You can't tell us that the tax cuts were awful and it was just a giveaway to the rich and billionaires and millionaires and big business and all the things that we heard from them, you know, screamed at the top of their lungs back in 2017 during this debate. And they spent years telling us that it was just a tax giveaway to the rich. If you have to extend those very tax cuts from Trump and the Republicans to 98% of the country to avoid huge tax increases, that proves they've been lying all along about the tax cuts. And the reason they have to, at least they're indicating in different areas, they're telegraphing that they want to extend 98% of the tax cuts, it's because of this other promise Biden made, that $400,000 magic number that he made up on the campaign trail. It's just A, incoherent, B, dishonest in terms of the deficit reduction that they're claiming. And then most importantly, I think C, underscoring that they just demagogued and lied about the tax cuts ever since they were enacted and during that whole debate and beyond.
Absolutely. I mean, it's blatant because President Biden has been championing the child credit. The TGA doubled the child credit from $1,000 to $2,000. Biden wants to push it back up to $3,000 or $3,600. But getting rid of the tax cuts that he demonizes so much would cut the child credit back to $1,000. So he wants all the budget savings from cutting the child credit back to $1,000 while also taking credit as the champion of the expanded child credit. It's completely two-faced. And it reminds me of the pandemic spending, where the Democrats constantly trash Trump for all the pandemic deficits, but then they also turn around and endorse all of the Democratic spending expansions that were part of that, the child credit, the rebates, all of these policies. They want to own all the policies, but they refuse to own the cost.
Yep, and they also don't want to acknowledge that the policies that the Republicans passed under President Trump and Republican majorities in Congress benefited the whole country. And they said that's not true. They said this is an attack on working people, an attack on the middle class. And I think Nancy Pelosi called it Frankenstein's monster. She used words like the apocalypse and things like that. And then actually it reduced tax burdens for every income group in the country. And now they're scrambling to say, oh, well, actually, we have to extend 98% of them, while separately boasting they're going to get rid of all the tax cuts because it has Trump's name on them. This is the type of thing that drives me crazy. I think it makes people hate politics. And it also, to me, again, underlines the fact that they are totally full of it on this. And then we haven't even talked about, I think, the terrible policy implications of raising taxes on Americans, any Americans. And we'll see how they pursue this. I just think it's really damaging for them in an election year to be saying that they are planning to make Americans' lives even less affordable and worse, because people are already very unhappy with the state of the economy and nervous about their own family's future. Which brings me to one more point. And I've seen some discussion about this, and I'd love for you to help explain this, Brian. What is this apparent proposal or scheme from Biden to tax unrealized capital gains? Is this real?
He claims it is. It's been in his budget. Virtually no country does this. What it basically says is that if you're a small business owner or you have stocks, you would pay taxes on the value of the gains every year, even if you haven't sold the stock or sold your business. Now, setting aside all the administrative challenges here, you have to figure out how to value your business every year. You don't necessarily have the money to pay the tax because it's in the business or it's in the stock. So you create a situation where you would have to sell your stock or possibly sell your business in order to get the liquidity to pay the tax. The other fun thing about this is if you're going to tax people every time their stock value rises, you're going to have to send them a check whenever the stock value falls. So if we go into a recession and the S&P collapses, they're going to be sending billion-dollar checks to Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett because it has to go in two directions.
No, it's crazy.
You tax them when it rises. You got to subsidize them when it falls.
So just so I understand this, like, let's say you've got a stock portfolio and it increases. So the stock market goes up. Under this proposal from Biden, the government, the federal government, would look at that and say, oh, that person on paper, their portfolio has gone up this amount, over the last year. They're not actually selling the stocks. They don't have that money. It's just theoretical gains in the stock market. But the value of their portfolio has gone up X amount in the last year. We're going to tax them 25% of it. And you're going to have to pay real money based on these sort of fake money or unrealized gains that you don't actually have in your bank account. I just, for the life of me, I don't understand, Brian, how that's not just like calamitous, economy ruining, insane. Like, why would they write that down on paper saying this is our idea?
I mean, it's insane because, again, as you said, you're not even taxing actual income. It's not income that has been received yet. It's theoretical income on paper that you have to somehow come up with the money to pay. You can't pay it out of the income because it doesn't exist yet. But they're seeing it as a way to tax the rich. They believe the rich are all escaping taxes, but this is not the way to do it. And there's a reason no country in the world does this, because it is administratively impossible. It is a headache. And again, do you really want the government sending checks out to billionaires when the stock market is dropping?
If that's part of the program that they come up with, it's nuts. It's totally nuts. And by the way, it's not only rich people who look at capital gains and own stocks and sometimes benefit from that. It's amazing that this is the president of the United States and his administration and the plan that they're putting out there in public, saying this is how we're going to get our fiscal house in order. It's just a sham. It's a sham that would be ruinous. And I think that should matter heading into a very important election in November. Brian Riedel is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he was for a long time on Capitol Hill. He knows this stuff backwards and forwards in terms of budgets and taxes and all the numbers. Brian, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, guys.
We'll be right back after this.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
It's the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. And tonight is the kickoff of the 2024 NFL Draft. A lot of NFL fans will be watching very closely to see who their teams will sweep up. So let's bring in the Guy Benson Show NFL Insider, producer Christine, a.k.a. Cookie. Cookie, you are on the clock, and I believe the pick is in. What do you have for us?
What was that?
You're our NFL insider, and you don't know?
No. Is that like a chime of some sort?
It is.
For what?
That is when a team has made their pick on the ESPN coverage, and they're about to announce their pick in the draft. That's the jingle that they play. You'd think that a hardcore football fan such as yourself would know that song in your sleep.
It's always that jingle? Because I thought it was a different jingle.
No.
When I heard it last.
It's the same one. All right, Cookie, the pick is in. Who do you got for your Jets?
Okay, Brock Bowers.
Tell us about him.
He's from Georgia. Tight end.
That's good.
And so he's going to catch the ball for Aaron Rodgers.
Okay. Is he a projected draft pick for the Jets?
That makes total sense. He could go at 10. Everyone thinks he'll go somewhere between 8 and 15.
Very good player. National champion.
Semi-cute.
One of the best prospects coming into the draft. Not the best position value, but one of the best players in college football.
Do you care about the cuteness, Christine, when you're looking at your draft board?
Why did you think I picked Aaron Rodgers? Don't you remember?
Yeah, but that wasn't a draft. That was an acquisition. Completely different. But we're out of time with our NFL insider, producer Christine. Thank you for those insights. And it's actually not a horrible pick. See what happens tonight. It's the Guy Benson Show. We'll be right back.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
At the start of today's show, we welcomed Brian Kilmeade, host of the Brian Kilmeade Show here on Fox News Radio, and of course, co-host of Fox and Friends. I'll be joining him on the couch tomorrow morning, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We had a good conversation across a variety of topics to begin today's program, and here is part of that conversation. The question is any of this a crime? And I guess the argument, again, as a non-lawyer, has been, well, if they categorized the money that was paid to Stormy Daniels a certain way other than what the perfect above board fashion should have been, that could be a crime. They're like, well, that's a misdemeanor and that expired
right,
like years ago. So they had to somehow turn this into like a violation of federal campaign laws that the feds even haven't charged here. They looked at it. They didn't charge. Alvin Bragg's predecessor looked at this, didn't charge. But now leading into the election, they dredge up this thing from years ago and dream up a new way to make it 2-3 dozen felonies.
Yeah.
It reeks to high heaven, Brian.
It does. And you have the president of the United States going there to a court. They didn't fully define what the charges were. So they said, well, just wait when this thing goes to trial. Just wait. Okay, we're waiting. What are the charges? So what they're doing now, according to reports, and it makes sense, they're all just trying to give Michael Cohen some credibility and some corroboration. Because when he gets on the stand in a week or two, or in 2 days after Karen McDougal, I think he's going to go on there, and they're going to first thing they're going to say is, weren't you convicted? Didn't you have tax invasion? Weren't you a part of this? Weren't you actually constructing some of the scheme, orchestrating it? And what is your greatest complaint that your client, this is the best line ever. Jonathan Turley says, I guess the main charge is that he listened to Michael Cohen, his lawyer, and that's Michael Cohen's axe to grind? Do you think Donald Trump was orchestrating this? This is so, Michael Cohen is so far behind it. When David Pecker was asked, does Donald Trump know what you were doing? He said, I assume so. The defense says, objection. What do you mean you assume so? He said, then I guess I may strike it. Donald, you don't know that Donald Trump knew about this, and you can't say or assume it. That's not, you can't use that as evidence.
And Michael Cohen has just no credibility, right? He'll say whatever he has to say on behalf of Trump until they have a falling out, and now it's all negative to Trump. The guy is admittedly a criminal, Michael Cohen. I mean, you're not dealing with high caliber, high character people here. And I'm sure this is what I'm thinking, Brian. They're going to have this just cavalcade of people coming before the jury. They're going to testify, and it'll be a bunch of sordid business, sordid stuff. It's like, okay, Trump, maybe he was directing it. Maybe he was winking at it. Maybe he had no idea or some combination. Even under the worst case scenario where Trump's like, you know, directing everyone to do precisely what he wants, it's still not a felony.
Well, Guy, think about this. One of the things they're saying is that he manipulated election. This scheme affected the outcome of our election. Let's back that up a little bit. Okay. How would the election be affected if Hillary Clinton didn't smash her server? What would have been on that server that we found out? What if Hillary Clinton didn't go outside her campaign to hire Perkins Coie and Mark Elias in order to scheme up this whole Russia hoax situation?
Yeah, what if they didn't pay for the the Steele dossier?
Yeah. Yeah, what about, I mean, all that affects an election. And for those people, say, let's take a step back from that. If I knew about Karen McDougal, I wouldn't have voted for Trump. If I knew about Stormy Daniels, I didn't vote for Trump. Really? Did you hear the Access Hollywood tape? It is those two stories to the 20th power. And he still won without a staff. They all basically resigned. He still won in the final hour. So what are you saying?
My full discussion with Brian Kilmeade, available online, GuyBensonShow.com. It's also part of our free podcast, the whole show, every day, absolutely free, on demand, GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. When we come back, it's the home stretch. A lot of kiddos running around the building today, and I wasn't sure why. Christine reminded me, but that raised another question. We'll get to all of that next.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch on The Guy Benson Show. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free. Hosting Fox and Friends tomorrow. In for Steve. See you in the morning, bright and early. Okay, so I was on the elevator here in our headquarters in New York today, and the elevator stopped at a floor before I was going to get off. And the doors opened, and there was just a pack of kids, like 7-year-olds, roughly. And they were all carrying on and yelling and screaming and having a nice time. They're all very cute. And I said, what is going on? And then I saw some other people in the hallways with kids when I was getting ready for hair and makeup earlier for TV. There were little children in the makeup chair getting all done up. And obviously, I was able to put two and two together. Christine had mentioned this, actually, in the weeks leading up to this moment. But she did confirm to me, today is Take Your Child to Work Day. And it seems like a lot of the employees here have done exactly that. And then, Christine, I was like, well, I thought you had been teasing the fact that little Megan, not so little Megan, 11-year-old Megan, she was going to be accompanying you to work. And unless you've got her stashed somewhere, I have not seen Megan here at Fox today. What happened?
We had the science fair today. She had the science fair today. So she really, truly believes, and I believe too, that she's going to get first place. So she wasn't missing that. It's the 5th grade science fair. She's waited for this moment.
And what is this science project that she's done that she believes will win?
She is trying to proved that she can make ice cream quicker than the average ice cream, which takes like 7 to 8 hours. She could do it at under an hour using dry ice.
Dry ice. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you were explaining that, was it last year with the science fair? She got docked by the teacher.
Because that was this year.
That was...
It was a diorama I made. She made.
Are there multiple science fairs?
Oh, this was just a project.
Oh, this is just a project, so not the science
multiple fair. Projects, if you remember, in elementary school.
So she had a few points reduced from her grade because, as you just said, sounded like mommy did most of the work, and the teacher figured that out and said, yeah, this was not enough. Megan, a little too much cookie?
Yeah.
Was the teacher right?
Yeah. I make a great diorama. I mean, I have figurines. Like, I made Charlotte's Web the barn. I had real hay in that barn.
Mm.
It was magnificent. Trees, real trees.
What did the spider web spell out in this diorama? Was it some pig?
So what I did was we made the spider web, and then I wrote with my left hand, some pig, and then we like hot glued it onto the spider web.
Okay. And the teacher's like, this is all a little too good.
Yeah.
A little too good.
Just a little bit.
So in order to not have Megan lose points on the science fair, were you completely hands off on the dry ice cream or what?
I did not touch the project, if that's what you're asking about. I did not.
No hands-on experience here.
But how
elaborate was this? Because I've seen them use like liquid nitrogen, I think, on cooking shows. Is that kind of what was going on?
Yeah, it was like we were like doing a real cooking show. Like we did fresh strawberry ice cream and watermelon ice cream.
Was the ice cream good?
It actually wasn't bad. The strawberry was delicious. The watermelon tasted more like coffee. We were very confused about that. Actually, do you want to hear the
probably
best?
Probably some science behind that, but I don't know what it is.
Do you want to hear the best part? And this was Megan's line. The conclusion was you can do this, but save yourself the time and go to Carvel.
That was
the conclusion.
Is that the conclusion that the science teacher is going to want?
I don't know if that's part of the scientific method. That's her answer.
Well, I think that's a reasonable conclusion. You go through all of this pain in the you know what to get ingredients and this elaborate method. Why? This is my approach to, like, for example, when people say, we've talked about this before, I'm going to make homemade pizza and it takes forever, or I'm going to make homemade sushi. I think it's okay to outsource that to the professionals who do it every day and then pay them to do it. And the same happens with ice cream.
Do you want to know something very funny? My whole life, I never understood why Judgy Joyce never baked. Never baked anything. And she would always say to us, the baker has a family too, and he needs to be supported. That's why we go to the bakery.
That's probably one of the reasons. So we've basically established Megan is not here with you today because she didn't want to miss her science fair, because she expects it's going to be...
She wants a ribbon.
A big triumph for her.
She wants a ribbon.
If she doesn't get the ribbon, then what happens? Is she going to regret not being in here with mom, especially because I'm in town? I mean, excuse me, I'm here.
It was hard. It was a tough thing for her to comprehend that she wasn't coming, because she looks forward to this every year. And I had said to her before we knew that it fell on the same date, I was like, you know, Megan, I think Guy Benson is going to be, because she calls you Guy Benson, just like you. I think it's like a kid thing.
Yeah, kids like to use the whole name.
Or she'll say, if she sees you on TV, mommy, your guy is on.
That works.
But I said, maybe you can be a part of the home stretch. And
oh,
Mr.
boy.
Benson can interview you about mommy.
I was going to say maybe next year, but here's the thing. When does bring your kid to school day kind of expire? Is it like before or after kids know about, say, the Tooth Fairy or the Easter Bunny?
I was just asking Brian Kilmeade's producer, because I said, next year she's going to be 12. Did we grow?
She'll be in middle school, yeah. Right?
Well, don't forget, her school goes up to 8th grade.
Okay, but like the equivalent of middle school.
6th grade.
Yeah, that's middle school for sure. Oh, for me, it was.
It wasn't for me.
I don't think you bring a middle schooler on Take Your Kid to Work Day.
No?
No. Maybe if she still believes in certain things, she's innocent enough to come in here. But
you wouldn't. Oh, we could have brought Kat in today.
Mm-hmm. That is what I had in mind. To just...
Well, no, I think Kat wasn't so sure she wanted to ruin it. Didn't we assign that to Jimmy? We were going to make Jimmy Fallon.
No, we were talking about Jimmy Fallon doing it, and then Kat, I think, was willing to do it, but she, of course, had hypothesized. Here's a scientific hypothesis that Megan knows. Megan knows all this stuff, and she's bilking the situation for gifts and presents that she wants. So, anyway, I would say maybe we can have that conversation with her next year, but I just don't think you bring a middle schooler to bring your kid to work day.
We'll see. We'll
I think
see.
There's, I think there's a cutoff. So, do they have any guidance? Like, do you see any high schoolers rolling in here?
Exactly the age you said, like 7 to 9.
Yes.
I have not really even seen a 10-year-old.
Because there's probably kids who are too young, really, to make it make any sense.
Well, there's a certain age. They have a...
Oh, they have a range?
Yeah, there's
What's
a range.
The range? That's what I was asking.
I don't remember. I know, I think you couldn't come before 6, and I don't remember the cutoff.
I would guess 6 to 10, 6 to 11, something like that. I think Megan's out of luck, unfortunately.
I mean, we could just bring her here.
You could.
We could make her work.
I think that there might be labor laws about that. So let's discuss that with HR.
Should I just go ask the big boss today?
I think maybe not today.
Not this week?
Not this week. It's got a lot on everyone's plate. We can punt that one to never.
Just leave him alone?
Punt that one to never, I think. That's one that doesn't need to go up the food chain very far. We were supposed to talk about something else here, weren't we?
Yeah, the ban of smartphones.
Oh, yeah. So there was a study. So this goes back to something you and I have discussed previously, at some length, actually. And there's more science backing my position. This is from Norway, a Norwegian study showing that banning smartphones in school significantly decreased doctor visits for psychological symptoms and diseases among girls in particular, reduced bullying across the board, improved girls' GPA and attendance, and among the kids that it benefited the most with smartphones being verboten in schools, lower-income kids. So I've been saying smartphones have to be a massive distraction in schools, and I think they should absolutely just be banned. You've been against that. Does the new data showing all the benefits of getting rid of these phones from the classroom, does that convince you?
From the Norwegians?
Yeah, from the study.
Do you know I know a Norwegian phrase? Takk for maten.
What does that mean?
Thanks for the food.
Okay, so that's wonderful, but what do you think of the study?
No, I told you this before. I mean, not all studies. You can't just put it on every single kid, like one study. And I just think for Megan, she doesn't have a smartphone right now, but when she does, she's going to be able to bring it to school because we've talked about this before. Mass school shootings are a problem in this country. And I need Megan to be able to get to me at any time, you know, be able to reach me at any point.
It just doesn't make sense. There's so much data showing that smartphones are deleterious in school settings.
I don't know what that means.
Bad. Hurtful to the kids. Harmful to the kids. Harmful to their self-esteem and the bullying and their grades and their attendance. Everything. If there is, God forbid, some sort of an emergency, I'm not going to say one specific kind. If there's some emergency at school, I don't think any kid having a smartphone is going to, like, to call you. What are you going to do? You're here at work.
Freak out.
Okay.
No, but I get what you're saying. Do you know what a bigger problem in schools are starting to be? The Apple Watch. Kids are showing up with that, and the teachers are they're going crazy over that.
Well, and that's kind of a version of a smartphone on your wrist where you can just like look down, who knows what's on it. So I'm just putting it out there, more information. I think it's important.
I love research. I love information.
And then you love ignoring it and sticking with your gut, because your gut never serves you poorly, Christine. We've established that certainly over the years. Speaking of, Megan's now of middle school age and she's, you know, becoming an adolescent. She was thinking about wanting to just walk home from school. What did you think of that idea?
Her and Bobby had thought about maybe starting when it gets nicer out for her to be able to walk home from school.
How long would the walk be?
10 minutes.
Okay, so reasonable. I would do that all the time as a kid.
I started crying. And I don't really cry. I'm not a huge crier. The thought of her walking home. Do you know, like, I can just imagine, like, those men in vans. And, like, now they're watching her. They're, you know, what's it called when they're always observing, like, the same place?
They're like casing the joint?
They're going to case her. So they'll know her route because I don't think she'll obviously take different routes. No way. No way.
You're not going to let Megan walk to school?
Uh-uh.
In broad daylight?
No.
It's just like totally irrational. But relatedly, you said there was some sort of incident at a store recently?
So on during spring break, the weather was terrible. So we did a lot of shopping, Megan and I. And one day we were at Target and she said, I'm going to go over to the shoe section. And I said, OK. And she goes, no, I'm going over. You go look at whatever you need to look like. I want to go by myself and just look at the shoes. And I said, OK. So I let her go. And then I didn't see her head anywhere. And I mean,
how long later? Like,
oh, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, tops.
3 minutes later, you didn't immediately see her.
I thought she was gone. I'm not kidding. I can't explain to you what went through me, the feeling that she was gone. I couldn't find her. And then
how
I
much
just,
did you look for her?
Well, I was calling. I was screaming her name and she wasn't.
Why were you screaming her name?
Because I wanted her to get to me. Like, I just.
But she was over by the shoes.
Well, I just started panicking.
You started screaming her name.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
So usually I hold her hand. We're in stores. And Bobby said, you got to stop that too. But
she's 11.
Yeah. She has to hold my hand when we cross any street. And Bob, Megan walked over to me. And she just held her hand up to me. And she goes, here, just take it. She just like wasn't worth it to her to go through this.
Yeah. So the walking home from school is not happening. And on that note, we're out of time. Catch me tomorrow morning, Fox and Friends, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time on Fox News Channel. I'm guest co-hosting. I'll be off the radio tomorrow, traveling back here on Monday. Have a great night. Thank you for listening to The Guy Benson Show.
Talk for Martin.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.